Hey, farmers and landowners, this is Damian Mason coming at you with a question. Have you ever had disease or pest problems cost you money by reducing your yield? Well, of course you have. We fight this, right? That's what production agriculture is all about, is working as best we can to put out a great yield. And to do so, oftentimes, you've got to overcome disease and pests. The problem is we usually treat those diseases and pests after the problem, right? So what if you could do it proactively? What if you had a tool that gave you predictive analytics so that you would know if you have things like corn rootworm, soybean cyst nematode, sudden death syndrome? Well, you have that tool now. It's from Pattern Ag. Pattern Ag, doing predictive soil analytics way beyond just the old days of sticking a probe in the ground every few acres and saying, hey, wow, we got some nitrogen deficiency here. They'll let you know if you have pests and disease. Go to pattern.ag. That's www.pattern.ag to learn more about this awesome technology and how it can help you increase your yields by taking care of diseases and pests before they cause you harm. Well, Grayson, thank you for being here with me on the Business of Agriculture. We've got a great program for you today. I've got John Duff. He is a grain sorghum guy. He's now a consultant to the National Grain Sorghum Producers. And you probably don't know a lot about grain sorghum. We're going to talk about it a lot because I believe it has a bigger role in the future as we get more scrutiny on agriculture's utilization of water. That's why I invited John Duff on here. So if you're listening, you're going to hear some really cool stuff. If you happen to be watching, because as you know, I released the Business of Agriculture on my YouTube channel. My backdrop's a little different today. I'm coming at you from a hotel room in North Dakota. And so let's get right to it. John Duff, you and I know each other. I speak at different stuff. One of your CEO of the National Grain Sorghum Producers was an audience I just did in Lubbock recently. So you and I know of one another. Years ago, back in my political comedy days, I was a speaker at the National Grain Sorghum Producers meeting. So I know a little bit about grain sorghum. I don't know nothing compared to you when it comes to grain sorghum. We rekindled this discussion because about a week or two ago, I had mentioned on social media that we're going to see more emphasis put on grain sorghum as a drought-tolerant crop, especially in a year like this, where everybody in the western part of the United States is, you know, screaming about how dry they are, increasing pressure on the water thing. The Alalaga Aquifer has been getting, you know, tapped for 100 years now. Took 10,000 years for it to become the Ogallala Aquifer, the biggest aquifer, I think, in the world, but certainly in North America. And we're going to have pressure on us to stop using the water. Sorghum's an option. Why are we growing corn in western Kansas where there's only 8 inches of precipitation? Maybe sorghum's the answer. Of course, we know the answer. The reason that we're growing corn in these areas is because of economics. You can make more money growing corn than you can grain sorghum. But I believe that those issues are going to change as water has more true economic cost. In other words, right now it's a lot about politics or about policy versus the actual cost. So these are my predictions moving forward. And I thought, why not bring in you and you can give us the scoop? So anyway, John Duff, grain sorghum, give us your background. Tell us about the thing, and then we're going to get to all those questions. I just want to throw it out there right fast for all of our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for that. And thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. I mentioned this to you in the email exchange, but your political comedy bit that you did for us almost a quarter century ago is really part of sorghum lore. I hear about it literally a couple of times a year. I hear mention from Tim, our CEO, about that bit that you did. So it's great to finally be on with you and visit. You're nothing like how you've been described to me as far as how you sound or even look.
Yeah. Well, back then, I would dress up as Bill Clinton and do a political parody show. I always say it was a lot like it was Saturday Night Live style humor delivered in the persona of Bill Clinton, personalized to your crowd. And so all of a sudden you got Bill Clinton as a surprise guest at a grain sorghum producers meeting. And they're like, believe it or not, we're able to pull some strings in Washington. And I would always have a little concocted introduction. Then I'd come in, hail to the chief and secret servicemen. I'd get up on stage. I know, how y'all doing? Thanks for having me here. You know, and then I'd do my whole bit. No, I did not inhale. Okay. So anyway, That's the old days. Yeah. So right. I look a little different now, sitting here in my hotel room with my Kansas City Royals visor on and a t-shirt. So anyway, your background, because I think, did I read 6.5 million acres is about how many acres of grain sorghum we have in the United States of America?
Yeah, 6.3 this year. So pretty Yeah, 6.3, pretty close. That's where we're at this year. Now we digress. Back to my background. Sorry.
Well, the point I'm gonna make here. Let's just go ahead and start at the beginning. There's 6.3 million acres, about 350 million cropland acres in the United States of America, right? So you're talking a couple percent of our acres are devoted to sorghum. Not very much.
It's tiny. It's really small. Now, regionally speaking, it's massively important, right? And I think I'll start global actually. So 100 million worldwide, then we'll go smaller. 100 million worldwide, fifth most important cereal crop in the world in terms of acres planted. And just like in the U.S., regionally speaking, it's a massively important crop. Fifth most important on a global scale. But then you look at very narrow areas like sub-Saharan Africa, parts of India. Other corners of Asia. It is a massively important crop that is everything. We have a researcher here in Lubbock who grew up in China, and the little corner of China that he grew up in, sorghum was everything to him. That the roof on the house was thatched sorghum. The bed was thatched sorghum. They ate sorghum. And when he came to the United States and went to school, what did he do? He did sorghum, and now he's a sorghum breeder here in Lubbock. And so it's a hugely important crop from a global perspective, and more so from a regional perspective when you look in different corners of the globe.
I love that overview. I just love that overview right there. And then, yeah, we do have to get to you. Like I said, to call you as your LinkedIn profile says, one of the world's foremost experts on grain sorghum, but 100 million acres worldwide. Again, that's still teeny, but it's regionally very important. Yeah. Compared to rice. Of course, you said it's the fifth most important grain crop, corn, wheat, soybeans, rice, then grain sorghum.
That's it. Yeah. And you know, it'll follow generally that same pattern in the U.S. too, right? There's fewer rice acres in the U.S. than there are sorghum, but you know, from a importance to the food supply and production and things, that rice usually jumps up there as one of the more important crops, even in the U.S. But the trend holds, right? Regionally speaking, massively important in the U.S. From my micro level and my background, I grew up west of Lubbock, a little town called Loveland. And this crop is intensely personal to me and has always been, because we're out of water too, right? Yeah. My dad's a small farmer by many standards. Yet he's got 38 irrigation wells that he fires up to water his roughly half irrigated operation. It's dire. It is really a problem. Our worst water is down 84% in the last 11, 12 years. Our better water now is what was our worst water when I was growing up.
Because you know, I'm from Northeast Indiana. We get about 38 inches of annual precipitation. There's essentially no irrigated land within a near drive of my property. We don't have these battles, and then we don't have the environmentalists after us for the water usage. We don't have the need to go out and, you know, punch wells to drill. And we don't also use words like worst water and best water. What the hell are you talking about? Worst water and best water when you're talking about your father's irrigation there in Texas.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks. I forget myself sometimes when I get down into these weeds. The wells that yielded a lot of water, right, when I was little, now I had seen massive declines. And the wells that don't yield a lot of water, they don't yield a lot of water today, and they have never yielded a lot of water. And so what we're seeing, and this is true in most parts of the Ogallala Aquifer, those wells that many, many years ago gave up a lot of water, and you just had as much water as you ever wanted, and you could grow corn, and you could grow alfalfa, and you know, maybe you didn't turn the wells off for parts of the year, and there was water running down the side of the road. Those wells, the water's gone. The way the formation is here in the Ogallala, it's like a glass of ice water, and you've got a straw in it. The water around the ice is like the water in the aquifer, and then of course the ice itself is the gravel. A lot of people think it is big underground lakes. It's really not. It's water. it's water and gravel all mixed together. And it's that, that mixture where the gravel is more coarse and bigger that the water would pump a lot. It 10, 20, 30 years ago, it would be as much as you ever wanted plus some. And today those formations just they're gone. It was easy to deplete it and those are just gone. And we're seeing that trend really, really across the Ogallala Aquifer. And so, to wrap my background, it's a personal one for me. My future is not on the farm. It's not in Leveland, Texas on the farm, as much as I would like it to be. It's not, because we don't have the water resources anymore to do what we did in the same way that we did it just 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. So we're talking about an operation that those farms are there, but for them to exist, you need water, and the water's not there. And the thing is it just simply you go out and turn the pump on and there's nothing that comes out, or is there a regulatory thing that says you're not allowed to turn the pump on, or both?
Yeah, well, it depends on where you are, right? So it's sort of a northwest, a continuum, right? There's Nebraska is really, 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 really tight on the regulations. There's some water districts in Nebraska where you're limited to just 2 inches of water. Inches would be an acre covered in an inch of water. So you're limited to 2 acre inches. Then it kind of progressively, as you move south, it gets a little less strict. Kansas is less strict, but they still have the same restrictions. In Kansas, usually it's about 12 acre inches. Oklahoma's a little less so. And then Texas is the Wild West. We can do anything we want. It's right of capture in the U.S. in Texas. You drill a well, you can pump as much as you want. The only thing that we've got down here around Lubbock in our water district is you can't pump. There's well spacing requirements, and so you can't be pumping, 40 wells on a little 100-acre field. So other than that, there's really very few restrictions in Texas on pumping. If you can pump it, you can put it out.
I see. So the point is, your family's operation, you can't even pump it. It's not there.
That's right. Yeah. And it is. I mean, it's just not as much as it needs to be. Right. Yeah. If we were to shrink our acres, that we're irrigating, then yeah, there's a point at which that we'd have all the water we needed if you're putting that water out across fewer acres. But the problem that we have, and this is really the crux of this whole discussion here, is we have now capitalized rural economies, farm businesses, entire industries, around the water and around the assumption that you're going to be able to put out, let's say, 12 inches. If you were to cut that back and maybe water half the acres, and now all of a sudden you've got 24 inches, that would be great, right? But now you've got half the acres, you can't pay the bank.
Yeah, right.
And make those payments. So that's the whole issue here. If we could wave a magic wand and we could cut these irrigated acres in half, then you buy yourself 10, maybe in 20 years in some of these places and what we're able to do and be effective irrigating. But we can't, because we have these payments we have to make. We have landlords that have gotten used to a certain amount of rent. You've got input suppliers and fertilizer, seed, chemical that are used to you putting out a certain amount based on the assumption that you've got, 100 irrigated acres. If all of a sudden you have 50, that changes the entire calculus. And that's the whole crux. And that's where sorghum, I think, has such a huge and significant role to play in this discussion.
I want to hear more about that. We're going to actually talk a little bit more about water, because, again, I just think it's the most important thing going. But I want to remind our listeners, there's a lot of misinformation. There's also a lot of good information to be had in the business of agriculture. I want to tell you about something I'm excited. My new sponsor, AgVisor Pro, founded by my buddy Rob Syke. You've heard him on this podcast before. AgVisor Pro is an app. You put it on your phone. Okay. You want to go on Twitter and just ask a bunch of people and get all the input? Sometimes that works. Also, then you get the trolls and you get the toxic Twitter where they come on and tell you you're a dumbass and you don't know anything. And why would you have to ask that? AgVisor Pro is not Twitter. AgVisor Pro is a network of agricultural experts. So it's very simple. You download it on your phone. You can find a person. Scroll through the AgVisor Pro app. It's free. Put it on your phone. AgVisor Pro. Put it on your phone. It's free. And you can just say, all right, I want to talk to somebody that knows a lot about irrigation or water issues or grain sorghum. For instance, you might find a guy like John Duff, one of the world's foremost experts on grain sorghum. And then you can ask him a question. Now, the thing is, he might say, yeah, but to take it to the next level, I'm going to charge you. That's all between you and him. In other words, his consultancy might be free or it might have a little fee. But the point is, you can find these experts at AgVisor Pro. Go check out AgVisor Pro. Put the app on your phone. It doesn't cost you anything to put the app on your phone, and you will scroll around on it. All of a sudden, you might find it's got a lot of value to you. All right. So, John Duff. About this water thing, since I teed it up, you know, very beginning of the podcast saying that I think grain sorghum has a role here. We're going to finish out on water, and then we're going to talk about how grain sorghum can fill this role, or better yet, solve some problems. You said, if it makes sense to everybody, I own a quarter section in the Panhandle of Texas, let's say, or in Lubbock area where you are. And I think it's worth a certain amount, but it's only worth a certain amount as long as I can get water on those acres. And then all of a sudden I can't get water on those acres because when your dad says, I'm telling you what, I'm going to use my water allotment, but I'm only going to put it on half my acres. And then he says, hey, Damien, I'm not going to water those ones that you own. I say, well, son of a bitch, that means it's not worth much anymore because now it's just tumbleweeds, right? So the argument there is everybody wants the water to be apportioned onto their acres.
Yeah, absolutely. AgVisor Pro. I just joined. You sold me. I think that that's a key piece, right? The land value thing is a huge problem. Fortunately, I think in that kind of example that you just gave, it's less about most of the time those quarter sections have some rights associated with them, and you're not worried as much about losing all the water associated with that quarter. You see that less often, right? There in Kansas, some you have that where water's being moved around, but in most cases, the water right is associated with that piece of land.
Okay.
And so it's a little less about, I'm a landlord. I've got a $4,500 an acre piece of farmland that is now going to be worth $1,000 because I'm not getting any water at all. It's a little less that and more, we only have the water for half, right? And so there is that land value impact because now if we're only able to cultivate half of that in irrigated farmland, then that impacts me there. So it's a little less about losing it completely and more about, you're prorating that down. But it's still a huge problem, right? Still a massive problem if all of a sudden your rent check is 60% of what it was and you got to pay the bank.
So dig this, John. I'm sitting here in my Kansas City Royals hat because I went to a Royals game at Kauffman Stadium in July when I was there for some work. So I'm not trying to piss off the Kansas people, but I do commonly use this as a reference. Why are we growing corn in Western Kansas where they get 8.5 inches of precipitation when we should be growing it places like Huntington, Indiana, where I'm from, where we get 38 inches? Corn's a very water intensive crop. The reason is because of the economics, but eventually the economics of water are going to, or the environmental aspect of water are going to force those people to grow less things like corn. And isn't grain sorghum, can I grow grain sorghum, I guess, with no irrigation?
Yeah, absolutely. We're 91% rain fed, right? In the U.S. in places like Kansas.
91% rain fed, meaning 91% of the sorghum in a country is dry land.
That's right. Yeah, that's correct. And in Kansas, it's even more than that. It's 95% dry land in Kansas, only 5% of the sorghum acres in the state of Kansas. And Kansas is where 50% of the sorghum acres are. So you picked a good cap to wear or visor to wear. So only 5%
of them. They still get pissed off at me when I tell them they shouldn't be growing corn and they think it's just me protecting the I states. But hey, I got no problem with Western Kansas. I like those people. I've done gigs out there, Dodge City, Ulysses. I like those people. But then again, they should be growing dry land stuff because the Oglala aquifer pressure is going to be an issue.
So I can't disagree with that. But the midpoint, right, of that, the compromise here is that sorghum allows them to keep growing irrigated corn. in a transitionary period. You're talking about economics. That's why they grew up. Yeah, economics. Yep. We're in a massively grain deficit region on the High Plains because we got all these mouths, beef cows, dairy cows, swine, and they're eating, and they're eating every day, and they're going to eat every day for the next however many years they're out here. I guess how long the water lasts. And so the key there is making sure it lasts as long as we can, so we can keep those value-added ag enterprises here. And as long as they're here, they're going to be paying for crops like corn. And so it's going to make sense to grow it. And so the key, I think, in the message that I take to growers who want to continue growing corn is look, I get it. It's a cultural thing. It's valuable. The feed yards want it. Keep growing it. But why don't you split your circle, you know, your sprinkler, your center pivot sprinkler, for those listeners of yours that are not in ag, you're flying over, you see all these green circles when you're flying over the High Plains. That's a center pivot sprinkler. Maybe you split that in half, right? Mm-hmm. You plant corn on one half and you plant sorghum on the other half. Mm-hmm. We have seen some incredible things in yields of crops when we see those scenarios. We have literally seen double the yield of any crop, sorghum, corn put together, come off of a field just by splitting it in half and planting sorghum and corn at different times. Mm-hmm. 3 weeks difference. That 3 weeks difference in water usage and water demand of that crop, mm-hmm. Of those crops on that circle, makes so much difference in terms of efficiency that we've seen yields double. Farmers are able to plant the half the corn and make almost the same amount of corn that they would have made limping around on that whole circle. Plus they've got another half of beautiful pristine sorghum that probably didn't take that much water and probably didn't take as much fertilizer.
So when that pivot goes around a circle, are you saying that it runs a certain rate on the corn acre, on the corn half, and then it decreases or doesn't run at all on the sorghum acres?
Yeah. I mean, like down here, for example, you do it with cotton. Down here in Lubbock, you do it with cotton. And early sorghum, so sorghum that's planted, you know, maybe a month earlier than cotton, to 2 weeks to a month earlier than cotton, is going to have its peak water need. Its peak water need is already going to be over. So water usage is already starting to decline on that crop before cotton is peaking in its water usage.
Okay.
And so now, all of a sudden, if you cut your acres in half, you have double the water to hit that cotton or that corn with when it's peaking in its water usage need. Literally, double the water.
So, you're
seeing double the yield.
So that pivot unit, you can make it so that from noon till 6, it runs this much water, but from 6, when it comes back around to noon on the clock, it doesn't run water at all? You can do that?
Yeah, or if the sorghum has already peaked in water usage and doesn't need anymore, you might not water the sorghum again, maybe one time to make sure it's ready for harvest. And you could just be, we call it windshield wiping wiping back and forth on one half on the corn all the rest of the year. It gets as complicated as you want it to get, right?
Okay.
You have soil pros, you use satellite imagery, and you can speed that pivot up, slow that pivot down based on the water needs in that portion of the field.
Okay, so let's go back to the sorghum thing, because somebody might be listening saying, well, you're not even comparing like stuff, Damien. You keep saying stop growing corn, grow more sorghum, whatever. I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying there's going to be the economics are the reason that it is what it is, and then there's going to be the economics of water, or worse yet, I believe there's going to be the regulation aspect of water. So answer me this. Are we going to see more regulation? You're a young guy. In the next 10 years, we're going to see more regulation on water. I say absolutely 1,000,000%. There's no way in hell it doesn't happen that way. We're going to see tighter scrutiny on water utilization in the next decade, period. You agree?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're going to see that pressure. We're certainly going to see it at the state level, right? The state level, it's going to happen. There's no way we can't, because we've already got those regulatory frameworks in place. In the next 10 years at the federal level, because the regulations aren't in place, I don't know. That's kind of a question of whether.
Well, I don't know. We just threw together a $1 trillion spending bill that they called an inflation reduction bill, which is really $400 billion of it plus is devoted to climate and green energy. So
no,
it can happen.
Yeah, it totally. I'm not saying it can't. I think we're definitely going to see those conversations happen more. And you know, I think that while I'm not going to sit here and argue for regulation of landowners, property owners, or anything like that, I think more emphasis in this area from government is not a bad thing at all. So the drought in the West, right? We're only talking about the Ogallala, and the real problem, arguably, is the far West. And we the drought right now. If you look back in history at previous droughts, it's the worst one in the West in 400 years. And if you go back to the middle 12th century, so about 800 years ago, the characteristics of that drought in the 1200s or the 1100s and today are very, very similar in terms of how much rain has fallen or not fallen, the heat, the duration, how long it's lasted. They're very similar droughts to the one in the 12th century. And that drought was the one that drove all the cave-dwelling peoples out of the Four Corners area. So those amazing cave dwellings in Colorado and Arizona that are vacant now, they were vacated during that drought that's very similar to the one we're facing now.
Hey, wait, and they didn't have water. John, I'm not getting political. Was it anthropomorphic climate change due to driving SUVs back 12 centuries ago that did this? I got to question that. Was it?
No, I don't believe that it was. I don't believe that you can say that was climate change that was driving that. And there have been some really, really nasty droughts before we had any industrialization at all.
I'm not sure that certain factions or people in Washington, D.C. have ever considered that. Okay, so we got a 1,200 year drought, I think, is what you're telling me, going on out west. And I've read that before. So talk about how your crop fits into it, because you and I both agree that water regulation is coming. You say the state level, I say it from everywhere, but also there's the environmental pressure. Whether it does or doesn't, there's also going to be the reality of the economics. We grow corn in these places because of the economics, but if water gets to where you can't get the damn stuff, what's alternative B? Alternative B, you grow something that doesn't need a lot of water, and also you're going to change your practices. I see a big change of practices, more cover cropping. I see less tillage because that is obviously gets rid of a lot of your moisture, et cetera. I see these things happening. You tell me your read and as it relates to sorghum.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're going to see all of those things, definitely. Sorghum is 75% no-till, right? So that means in the U.S., 74% of farmers are not dragging iron through the field. And say what you want to about climate change, that's less exhaust pumping out of the air, right? And not a bad thing. It's less fuel that's being used, right? And that means less money that the farmer's having to spend. So, and that means banking water, right? We're banking the water. We're not plowing and turning that soil over and letting the water all evaporate out of good, rich dirt that's got plenty of water in it. So those things are great. Cover crops, absolutely going to see more. That's nuanced, right? Adoption in the far, or the Western Plains has been slow because farmers worry about yield drags and taking all the moisture for next year's crop. And so those are questions about how that gets adopted. But we're definitely going to see more, no doubt. And you're going to see more sorghum, and you're going to see it in grain, in the form of grain, and you're going to see it in the form of forage, too. Forage is the most water-efficient crop there is, period, right? You're not producing a big grain head that's got a lot of fat in it, or a ear of corn that's got a lot of fat in it. It's got a lot of protein in it. And so it needs less energy. So you can make a lot of forage. You can make a lot of a really high quality forage if you're growing sorghum on a fraction of the water of other crops. In the plains and in the far West, we've got I said it at the outset, we're like 75-80% grain deficit in the plains. That means we have to bring in 80% of what we're feeding to our animals in terms of grain. So we're set up to do it, right? We've got the rail infrastructure. We've got the truck infrastructure. We've got elevators. We can bring it in from Iowa all day long.
Hey, up in the Midwest, we're happy to do that. You keep those rails going. We'll keep sending you the stuff. It's all right.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. We're set up to do that. We can bring that in. We can bring the grain in. We can't bring in forages. We can, but it's not anywhere near as easy, right? So it's the future of the Western Plains, I think, is even less in grain sorghum than it is in forage types. Silage, hay grazer, soudan grass, all these various crops that
you're growing. Yeah, I mean, and not even alfalfa. Like alfalfa doesn't do so well with the heat. So it could be, like you said, soudan grass and some of these other triticale or something like this.
Yeah, the vast majority, I think, is going to be sorghum or something like triticale, definitely.
Okay, so let's talk about where sorghum fits in, because sorghum isn't just a food. It is, you chop it like silage, like corn silage. It does have a head on it. The head of it, and you better answer the big age-old question. I've heard milo, I've heard millet, I've heard sorghum. Are they all the same thing?
No. So yes and no. So milo and sorghum are the same thing. There's some long history on why it's called milo, why it's called sorghum, what the relation is there, but it's the same crop called two different things. I grew up alternatively knowing sorghum is six different things, and we used them completely interchangeably. millet's a completely different species, though, right? Millets, speaking broadly, are several different species of small grains that look a lot like sorghum growing, and they have kind of the same nutritional profile of sorghum, and they work really well as feed too for various livestock and even human food.
But millet is not sorghum, and sorghum is not millet.
That's correct. Yes, sorghum is sorghum bicolor, genus and species sorghum bicolor. That's what sorghum is, and sorghum is a lot more narrow in that nomenclature. It just has a whole lot of common names, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Sorghum, milo. You told me six different things that you call it.
So and some of them make no sense, right? Let's see: sorghum, milo, grain sorghum, grain feed, and get this one: maize. West Texas calls sorghum maize, and really, it's, you go back and read old academic papers and stuff. They called it milo maize. Milo was an old line of sorghum back in the days before hybrids. Okay. And so it was a common name. They called it milo maize. And then at some point they dropped milo and just started saying maize. And West Texas is the only place that still calls sorghum maize. But of course, that's corn.
That's funny. Yeah, maize is corn. And I still call sorghum grain sorghum because, all right, so it's got a big head on top of the plant. It doesn't have husks. It doesn't have silks. It's not like corn. It's not really a grass plant, is it?
It is. Yeah, it's a grass. The fits the grass family Poaceae or Graminae. It's a grass. It's a first cousin of corn. Corn, sorghum, sugarcane are all three first cousins.
So good.
No, I was going to say it's same crop as corn from a compositional perspective. You said it a little while ago, something about substitution, and people ask you why you talk about two crops that aren't comparable, but the fact is they are comparable, right? They're very similar. Sorghum is higher in protein than corn, but it's lower in fat and it's similar in starch. So that little trade-off there is you're trading some fat for some protein. Sorghum doesn't work as well.
It's higher in fat, but lower in protein, but the carbohydrate content's pretty much the same.
Yeah, sorghum's higher in protein, lower in fat, but the carbs are about the same.
Higher in protein.
And it doesn't work as well straight up as a cattle feed, partly because we've built now the whole feeding industry around feeding corn. And so its milling characteristics and stuff are different. And so it doesn't work straight as a cattle feed. But if you put it through an ethanol plant first, there is no difference in the two feeds. They yield the same amount of ethanol, and the feed value on the back end of the ethanol plant, distiller's grain, which is the leftover from after making ethanol out of grains, is the same. It's priced the same. It looks a little different, but the composition is almost identical into a feed yard. And that's why, again, this is such a, you can even store it in the same bin. So on the High Plains, you really you're swapping the two out.
Yeah.
It's really not a lot of difference. Agronomically, it's the same, but one uses a lot less water.
So from the standpoint of, like you said, it doesn't work well going into beef rations. And you're talking about the dry grain, the stuff that's, again, we cut it off the top. It's an interesting thing because, you know, your corn is halfway down the stalk, but on grain sorghum, it's on top like a head of wheat or something, although it's more like a corn plant with the head, like a head of wheat up on top of it. We go through and we cut it when it's dry. How many bushels or pounds do we get per acre of grain sorghum?
So, you know, our national yield is, it sucks. It's not impressive at all, but it's nuanced, right? So
the national yield on corn is 177 roughly last year.
77 on sorghum, right?
So less than half of that. So 77 Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
77 bushels per acre.
That's right, but it's nuanced. So that 77 bushels per acre grown mostly in desert.
Yep.
Right. So if you redid the national corn yield, just counting the counties where sorghum is grown,
yeah,
then it's a radically different story. And yep. If you throw out the irrigated acres of yep. corn that are grown in those areas and just look at dry land, so it's more of a head up comparison, you'd be looking at like a 40, 50 bushel yield on dry land for corn nationally if you were just to look at those dry land acres that overlap the sorghum industry.
How many? Okay, how much am I selling a bushel of sorghum, grain sorghum for? And where do I go with it?
Yeah, so we usually run in the last 15-ish years, we run in that 95% of corn value is where sorghum is running.
Okay, so if corn is $6, you're talking about it's going to be $5.70 or something like yep. that. It's really
yep. cool. Yeah, really close. Yeah. And it depends on the year where you're going with it. So historically, and I say historically, from about 2007 in the ethanol build out to about 2013, we saw, which that was kind of when my career started. So to me, that's historical.
Yeah.
That time, it was about a third of the industry, about a third of the bushels went to the ethanol plant, about a third of them went to the export market, and about a third of them went to livestock feed. And then there was sort of a, you know, kind of a rounding error in there that went to human food, pet food, bird seed, kind of specialty uses, a little bit of industrial stuff, some packing peanuts, things like that. 2013 came along and China started buying grain sorghum. They took their first load in August, I think, of 2013. Uh-huh. And they didn't stop until the trade war. They in the trade war, they not only stopped, they hit a brick wall and it fell down.
Right.
But until then they were buying 75-80% of the sorghum crop, every year without fail. Trade war, what that was off the rails. That's a whole other podcast. We can do that later. And then the trade war, ended and, the phase one deal took over and it's been back in good shape since. So that kind of realigned the industry. Now we see probably 50 to 70% of the crop goes to the export market, and then another, you know, 10 to 30, depending on the year, goes to livestock feed and ethanol each. And then food, of course, is growing. We're probably 5 to 10% of the crop now is gone to human food.
And that wasn't historically where it went. But now it's going into right. human consumption, and that's in what sort of products are we talking about?
Everything. This is, I'm telling you, it, like I said, say what you want to about climate change. The environmental focus of the U.S. consumer right now is significant. Whether yeah. you think that's right or wrong, it's a big deal. And we check all those boxes, right? Gluten-free, non-GMO, yeah. not much tillage, uses less water. Yeah. It's not often organic, but can be organic. And because there's less tools in sorghum anyway, from a herbicide perspective, it's kind of easier for it to be organic. And so we meet a lot of those needs. And so you're seeing that increasingly in the snack products. The milling nut was recently cracked. It's a little harder to mill, but that's been solved by and large. And so we're seeing it more and more into flour products. It pops really well and it doesn't have the big kernel that corn has. And so that doesn't get stuck in your teeth. And so we see those in a snack products where that's a big deal. Extruded products, sorghum puffs, that market has just really blown up. And then it's now, like I said, probably 5 to 10% of our total bushels.
So here's my question then is, you said it checks a lot of boxes, and I'm calling this, you know, episode is grain sorghum, you know, an answer for restricted water usage, because you and I both agree on that whole thing. It also checks a lot of boxes for the consumer, the whole consumer that says, I want to know where my food comes from. Now I want to know that I'm not destroying the environment when I eat. There could be a big push here for this. Do those 6.3 million acres in the U.S. double in the next few years?
Yeah, they absolutely double. How many years it takes, I don't – it's those big wholesale changes are hard to get because, like we talked about, the capitalization.
Well, you need the infrastructure, right? You need a place for the shit to go, right?
Right. Yeah. Those changes are hard to make happen overnight. And so it's hard to see that happening. But yeah, 10 to 20 years. I mean, you think it's bad now. Think about how we're going to be 10 to 20 years from now. And again, we haven't even talked about the far west and all the almond trees that are getting torn out and the challenges that creates. So I think over time, yeah, we see a massive increase in those in that amount of acreage, and talking about not having a place for it to go. If we could get some consistency, I think in the U.S.-China relationship, trade, political, whatever, they'll take all we can grow, to be perfectly honest. And really, to this point, politics aside, it's really been infrastructure that was the bigger challenge. Mm-hmm. On the Chinese relationship really, really flourishing. We hear this so many times. We hear from Chinese buyers that come over here, or we hear them when we go over there, we need more, we need you to grow more. And our response is always, we need a bit earlier. We need you to be more aggressive early rather than calling me 2 weeks before the crop is out of the field. And that's just an infrastructure thing. That's just an adjustment in one side and the other learning how each other does business and needs to do business. They don't happen fast, but when that does happen, and I think it will, population declines aside, and you've done some great podcasts on that. I've listened to them. I don't know if I totally agree, but you make some really, really strong points, and I think we will definitely see some of those phenomenons play out in China. That aside, their diet is going to continue to get better, and they're going to need more and more protein. And so I think they're only going to need more sorghum in the future. It's just a matter of when they buy it, how early they buy it, and whether the farmer has the ability to actually respond to that. All those things line up, and yeah, we could see 10 to 15 million acres again in the U.S.
But John, you know what? It's not just China. I mean, I don't think we want to predicate the success of sorghum on China, because you give me a lot of ideas here. Totally. First off, ethanol, if sustainable aviation fuel, I did an episode about that a few months ago.
Yes.
If that is real, then the ethanol does not go away. I predicted ethanol would go away with this whole electric vehicle crap, although it's running, the electric vehicle push is having some breakdowns, shall we say, along the road. Look at California right now, where they're telling their residents, don't turn your air conditioning on. It's 114 outside. And also you got to buy an electric car. But there's the ethanol aspect of this grain sorghum product. There's the fact that it can be used a bunch of ways. If you green chop it, isn't it like a corn silage, or am I wrong in that?
It is. It is. And actually the fiber quality of that corn stalks them by themselves are not the best fodder in the world. They weren't really bred for that, right? The crop was bred going back to when it was bred from by hand from Teosint hundreds of years ago. It was bred to make starch and fat in a grain head. Sorghum was bred for a number of things because of its history as a feed crop. And so the fodder quality, the fiber quality in a sorghum plant is superior to most feedstuffs. Now, it is less fat, right? But like we talked about a second ago, you can bring fat in on the rail. Fat's easy to bring on the rail by bringing in grain corn or by straight up bringing in tanks of corn oil from ethanol plants in South Dakota and Iowa and Minnesota and Illinois. More on that point, I want to go backwards for a second. You mentioned sustainable aviation fuel. I love that you mentioned that. Some really, really, really rough math here. And by 2050, the global aviation fuel market is going to be 175 billion gallons. Okay. 10% of that, right, is 17.5 billion gallons. Okay. What is the total nameplate production on the U.S. ethanol industry? About 17 and a half, right?
I mean, it's more. You're saying that the entire ethanol capacity right now,
yes,
would be just
10%
of sustainable aviation fuel if it comes to fruition.
Yes, we hear this all the time. We hear these fears and these worries, and I've thought about it too, right? Like as we move more toward electric vehicles, and we're going to. I mean, whether we replace the fleet or not, it's a different story. I personally don't think so, but we're going to move toward more of those vehicles, right? That's not going away. And so should that trend worry us in agriculture that's dependent so much on the ethanol plants? And I would say no, because the sustainable aviation fuel market is going to grow in such a way that if you're able to gain market share in that market, and I think we are, I think the consumer's demanding those more environmentally friendly fuels, right or wrong. Mm-hmm. And so if we can claw into that market share, then I think we're going to find a home for all those gallons of all those plants that are in existence today. Are you going to see a big renaissance and a boom and a doubling of the size of the ethanol industry? I don't know. But we could definitely keep a foothold in the fuel market and for our grains in the United States. And so I think that's something to be excited about and something that we shouldn't stay up too much worried about electric vehicles because, like you said, they're going to have issues. And then beyond that, there's other markets.
Well, I wanted to have you on here because I think ethanol fits a lot of bills when I look at the future. I see the water, the fact that it's easy on water. And incidentally, if I wanted to get to 77 bushels of, per acre, which is your national output, can I do that on 6 inches of annual percent at 9 inches? I mean, what's realistic?
Yeah, absolutely. I can get into that math and share it with you. But
in rough terms, if I'm somewhere that gets 10 inches of annual precipitation, does that grow me an average bushel, an average sorghum crop?
Yeah. So it roughly takes about 6 inches of water to get to that first bushel of sorghum. And so if you just say 6 inches, you knock that off, you get about 4 inches left. Speaking from a strict physiology perspective, this theoretical, that 4 inches that you've got left over, I just calculated it, is 34 bushels that are guaranteed there. Now, we've seen big increases in water use efficiency, and I think those old rules of thumb, in this case, it's 480 pounds per acre inch. I don't think they really apply anymore. I think we've seen great improvement. And so to answer your question, yeah, absolutely. I think we do. I think we are able to see on limited water some pretty incredible things. Will we be able to have 77 year in and year out? Probably not. This is a desert after all. Every other year it's going to be 30. If over the long term, as we continue to see genetic improvement in the crop, which happens with or without investment, right? Just heterosis, biology, things get better over time.
The sorghum man is using livestock terms, heterosis, just for people that don't think that that's some sort of a disease of your hetero. We better tell them what heterosis is.
Yeah. So sorghum is a hybrid, right? As a male parent, a female parent, and many crops are. So corn is a hybrid, same way. There's a male parent and a female parent, and those are crossed together and make a hybrid. Every generation of that, right, gets better and better and better and better. And we see that. We've seen that in humanity over time. Yeah. We get more and more skilled. We get more and more athletic. We get smarter and smarter. In a lot of cases, we get taller and taller. That's, you're seeing heterosis play out. And so as we see that in genetic improvement in crops, we're going to see more and more and more efficiency over time.
Yeah, well, again, heterosis should make it so that with less resources and you should be able to get more yield with less resources over time is the idea. I'm digging on this. I want to remind my listeners here, do check out Eggvisor Pro. Like I said, it's a company founded by my buddy Rob Syke. He's been on here a number of times. He's a smart guy. He basically looked out there at the marketplace and said, you know what? Some smart person found a guy that needed a ride and a guy that has a Toyota Camry, and all of a sudden it became Uber. Why don't we do something like that with ag? Some smart person in the plains, like our buddy Mr. John Duff right here, has a lot of knowledge about grain sorghum. You want to access that knowledge. Get on the Agvisor Pro app and find the John Duff equivalent who's on there as an expert. Look him up, and all of a sudden, you two can have a relationship where all of a sudden you get the knowledge and he gets a little bit of payment from you. Agvisor Pro, go check it out. It doesn't cost you anything to put the app on your phone. Just go do it. Check it out. You'll be happy you did. All right. The future, I'm pretty excited about it for you. I'm pretty excited about it's almost like, you know, when I was a kid, you talk about, you know, looking back historically, we had the big three automakers, and then there was poor old AMC. And they made the Javelin and the Pacer and the Gremlin. Pretty cool cars now when you look at them, kind of dopey, big, weird things. They're like the fourth. You're like the fifth. Okay, corn and soybeans. Everybody gets excited about corn and soybeans. Sometimes we get excited about wheat. Here in the United States, we don't even talk about rice. My buddies at Extreme Ag down in Arkansas talk about rice, but you don't even hear about rice. And then you're like, grain sorghum? What the hell are you talking about? I want to bring more attention to your crop. I'm inspired to go and buy some of these farms in Western Kansas that think I've been bashing on them just so I can make people grow grain sorghum. That's how excited I am about sorghum. Are you excited about the future of this crop?
I'm excited about the future of this crop. I think we're for all the reasons we talked about, whether it's sustainable aviation fuel, sustaining the ethanol market.
Water.
Protein needs.
It's water.
Water. I say this all the time. You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter from a sea level perspective. It doesn't matter what happens if we poison our drinking water or we don't have any drinking water. It doesn't matter. I'm not saying carbon's not important, but carbon is something that's longer term. It's there's questions around the science. It's hard to quantify these things. But if we can't drink clean water, we will not survive as a human race.
That's right.
And that's why it's the most, that's why I'm the most passionate from an environmental perspective about water, about protecting those water resources, about preserving those water resources for ourselves and for future generations as well.
Yeah. And sorghum can help us get there because it's less water dependent and it still gives us a crop and it still gives us something that's going to be growing out there. And all of a sudden you don't have dust bowl conditions because, oh, well, because the other answer used to be, well, let's just take half the land and not plant anything. Well, then all of a sudden, you know, it's blowing away. Grain sorghum meets a lot of sorghum. Milo meets a lot of Milo maize. It meets a lot of those answers. If people want to learn more about grain sorghum, John, where do they find you?
Absolutely. National Sorghum Producers website's pretty easy, sorghumgrowers.com. We have also, let me make sure I get the URL right. If anybody wants to buy sorghum food, or they want to learn more about sorghum food or anything, simplysorghum.com will take them to a page that will tell them everything they need to know about sorghum and have links to go buy sorghum as well.
That's fantastic. And then if they want to find you personally, I know that I've got your email, but you have a social media. You're on LinkedIn.
LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Handles are all some iteration of sorghum and duff. You can find me. As you will see on my profile, I'm one of the world's foremost experts on sorghum.
All right. Some iteration of sorghum and duff. His name's John Duff. He's a consultant and former
executive director. Vice president for National Sorghum Producers.
National Sorghum Producers Association. He's a foremost expert on sorghum, and he was very gracious, spent a lot of time on this topic. And I know that this is a little bit of a long episode, but dear listeners, I thought it was one of the more informative ones I've been able to pull off here in the last couple of weeks, because I like this topic and I think you're going to see more of this. It fits into a lot of where I see trends going. And that is, of course, environmentalism, water regulation, and a consumer that wants to participate in that, not just the environmental regulation that we're going to see. So John Duff, I'm glad we got to finally meet. You've been hearing about me since my Bill Clinton days. I think it was 1998, I think it was, down there in Tucson, Arizona, where your association met. I got on stage and said, I don't know anything about sorghum, but you know what? I was going to be, maybe I could help you interview your potential interns. That's a little throwback to the Bill Clinton days. All right. Till next time, he's John Duff. That's David Mason. It's the Business of Agriculture. Hey, thanks for being here. This episode of the Business of Agriculture was brought to you by Pattern Ag. You've heard me talk about Pattern Ag because I think it's a pretty cool concept. New technology that allows you to predict the problems you're going to have and therefore treat them before those problems cost you money. What kind of problems am I talking about? Pests and disease. Things like corn rootworm, sudden death syndrome, cyst nematode, and a whole bunch of other bad things that happen out there in the field that can cost you money. Guess what? Pattern Ag will let you find out ahead of time if the disease or the pest pressure is there, and therefore you're treating it before it costs you any money. What a great concept. Go to pattern.ag, that's www.pattern.ag, to learn more about their product, their technology, how it can make you money, save you yield, and also where you can find a rep that can come out there and do the work for you. Pattern.ag.